Billie Holiday is one of the most iconic jazz performers of all time. Her voice is certainly unmistakable, but for many, her religious sensibilities may be invisible. In Religion Around Billie Holiday, Tracy Fessenden delineates the religious worlds that shaped Holiday and her music. Fessenden takes the reader through Holiday's short but full life by placing it within the context of Catholicism, Black vernacular music, jazz compositions, and the culture of American celebrity. She shows how race, gender, and religious conditions guided her sound and formed the prism through which her genius shone. In our conversation, we discussed Holiday's early Catholic formation, the Jewishness of the American songbook, Afro-Protestant notions of redemption, confessional performance, the eclectic religious orbits of her jazz contemporaries, strange fruit and the vigilante faith of some Southerners, the cinematic representation of a musician's life, and the mytho-poetic nature of Holiday's iconicity. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion, a channel of the New Books Network. And now my conversation with Tracy Fessenden about Religion Around Billie Holiday, published with Penn State University Press in 2018. Welcome, Tracy. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you?
I'm doing well, Christian. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for writing such a wonderful book. It's beautifully written. It's really a joy to read. And it brings up so many interesting kind of intersections in terms of American religious and musical history and issues of race and gender and all sorts of great stuff. So I'm excited to talk about the book. We always love to hear about our authors, though, before we get into the book. So could you tell us a little bit about some of your training, mentors, or scholarship that has been formative in shaping the types of projects you work on? How was your entry into the study of religion?
Wow. I had an unusual formation, I think. I majored in English in college at Yale. And when I left Yale in the mid-80s, I had a sense that English as it was taught and practiced there might not be the direction that I wanted to go in. I was looking for a place where I could ask bigger questions and maybe have a little bit more freedom to look more broadly at other kinds of expression. Yale in the 80s, of course, was extremely theoretical. And although I was drawn to that language, I thought that there might be other vocabularies, other conversations that would be nice to know how to join, nice to be a part of. So I looked, I took a little bit of time between college and graduate school, and I looked at various kinds of programs that would allow me to do literature in conjunction with some other things. And I discovered religion and literature, which at that time was done at a few places, Chicago, Yale. The program at Chicago had been started by Nathan Scott, who had moved to Virginia. And that's how I ended up at Virginia. I applied to the program there in religion and literature. And for whatever reason, they decided to gamble on me, even though I had absolutely no formal training in religious studies when I started graduate school. So the program at Virginia was very eclectic. We were able to take classes in lots of different areas, which was terrific. But when I graduated, I think I applied for every single job that came around in religious studies that year because I realized I don't quite have a specialty. I can just fit myself into whatever conversation you want me to be a part of. Not necessarily the best training to begin writing about something that I could claim to be any kind of expert in. But, after a few years of teaching, my first teaching job was at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, which was a wonderful beginning to my career because it was very teaching intensive, very student focused, and I was able to teach a lot of different things. When it came time to think about my first book, I realized that the way in which religion and literature had been taught at the University of Virginia wasn't quite the way in which I wanted to pursue it. And that is, in general, the sense was that we could talk about religion as it was mediated through very secular forms and just sort of assume that that's where religion was most active. It wasn't necessarily in the pews. It was happening all around us. And that was very appealing to me. But what I was missing was any sense of a particular genealogy by which we would recognize religion as such when we found it in very secular forms. One of the books that was very influential for me in the early 90s was a book by an English professor at Berkeley, Jenny Franchot, who wrote a book called Roads to Rome about how 19th century discourses about all kinds of things, not just religion, reflected or mediated a kind of Protestant anxiety about Catholicism. And this was a nice way for me to think about the way in which Protestant forms more easily translated into secular forms than did Catholic or Jewish forms in American public and political and legal discourses particularly. So I began to think about that, how what we take to be the secular is really a kind of very diffused form of Protestant discourse that still does the kind of boundary maintenance between what is legitimate religion and what may be considered problematic or overly literal or overly embodied or overly extravagant kinds of religious claims. So that's how I got into the kind of work that became the basis for my first book, Culture and Redemption, which was all about American literature and American religion as a kind of Protestant, a large Protestant articulation of the secular, into which other religious forms needed to find their way in somehow or not. So that was a wonderful project. It for me, it was extremely enjoyable, and I've been very happy with the reception of that book and the kinds of projects that it has launched for other scholars. The Billie Holiday book was something that I didn't come up with entirely on my own. The series editor for the Religion Around series, Peter Kaufman, who is now at the University of Richmond, had the idea, based on some of his own work and some of the frustrations, I guess, he was feeling in talking about Shakespeare, which is one of his areas of wonderful expertise, talking about Shakespeare and religion without necessarily talking about particular church forms or particular controversies over conversion and so on. He wanted to be able to talk about Shakespeare in the context of a religious world that might have come to impinge on Shakespeare and Shakespeare's production in ways that, might not necessarily come to our attention if we weren't looking for the way in which religion just sort of floats in the background for many artists, for all of us generally, and influences us whether we are conscious of making religious kinds of decisions or not. So he wrote a book, Religion Around Shakespeare, and then invited some other authors to think about iconic figures whom we could approach in this way, as shaped by religion in their environment, without themselves necessarily needing to be thought of or framed or approached as religious figures in their own right. So he came to Arizona and talked with me about this project and said, if you were to do a book like this, whom would you write about? And just out of my mouth came Billie Holiday, because the project struck me as so inventive and ingenious, and the premise seemed so open-ended and very exciting in that way. And I thought, well, if I'm going to sit down for a few years and write about someone, anyone, who could I write about and never, ever grow bored, never grow tired, never think that this was not a good idea? So he said, brilliant, write Religion Around Billie Holiday. So I said, okay. And then a couple of years later, he said, so are you really going to do this? And I said, well, okay. And then I had a sabbatical and was able to put a proposal together and think about how it might work. But it was really, it was kind of a dare. I thought, okay, this is someone I adore. I know very little about her. I didn't necessarily think I had the chops to write a biographical kind of project about Billie Holiday, about a jazz singer. But there were, there were some things that looking back now, I see did prepare me for this kind of project, or that I was able to use from my earlier work. Culture and Redemption ends with a chapter on F. Scott Fitzgerald and the Jazz Age. So there I am picking up, in the 1920s, which is when I start to think about Billie Holiday, who was born in 1915, thinking about jazz as a very complicated, rich, layered, collaborative production among American musical artists and the audiences and producers and interpreters and songwriters who shaped their production and our reception of it. That was a very, very interesting project to bring religion into. So it was a wonderful, wonderful exercise for me, and I'm pleased with the way that the book has turned out, and pleased with the reception, and glad I took Peter Kaufman up on his offer.
Yes, yes, we're glad as well. Like I said, it is a wonderful book, and we're excited to talk to you about it. I want to just before we get into Billie Holiday herself. I really like this Religion Around series. I think it is very innovative in many ways. I'm wondering what was your approach to the concept of Religion Around? Because there are a multitude of ways you could do this and think about it. I think you're very successful. But Peter and other authors in the series have their own kind of approach. So perhaps what might you, now having written this book, how might you advise others to think about this Religion Around concept as an approach?
Well, one of the things that I'm grateful to Peter for, and I think that the premise of the series allows, is to talk about religion in ways that are very specific, but that don't necessarily involve us in making particular claims on behalf of the figure at the center of these studies. So, for example, I get a lot of questions about Billie Holiday. Well, was she Catholic? Was she a believer? Did she believe X or Y? And that's not really my interest or my emphasis. It's not those aren't questions I feel qualified to answer, because I don't have access to her interior life. But we do have access to the world around Billie Holiday, or the world around these figures. And I think that we can talk about religion as something that had very specific kinds of powers, very specific ways of appearing, ways of impinging upon Billie Holiday and others. We don't, if we are interested in a figure who maybe him or herself was not particularly religious, we can talk about religion without defaulting to some amorphous category of spirituality or ethics or something that is very nonspecific but feels a little bit, a little bit religious. We can still talk about Judaism. We can talk about Catholicism. We can talk about various church practices or church doctrines and think about those as having real effects in the lives of people whom they touched in whatever way, even if the figure at the center of these inquiries doesn't him or herself profess a particular religious identity or a set of religious beliefs. So that was something that I felt very, very good about, that we can show religion to be important, to have a worldly force, a material force, a very specific kind of presence in the world without necessarily needing to pin down anyone's specific religious identity in the process. I've gotten some, I think one of the big surprises for many people who read this book is how shaped Billie Holiday was, as I argue she was, by her Catholic upbringing, particularly her the time that she spent in a Catholic reform school in Baltimore. And I've sensed that some people want to read Billie Holiday as being a little bit more Catholic than she ends up being in this book, or they're frustrated that she doesn't become or doesn't come to appear as someone who was particularly graced by her Catholic immersion, wasn't saved or redeemed by a particular relationship to Catholicism. But the sources I have, and the kinds of interpretations that I was moved to pursue, suggest that she was very shaped by Catholicism, even though she didn't necessarily imagine herself as having been saved or delivered from the very, very difficult life that she led as a result.
Now, I hope there are not listeners who don't know who Billie Holiday was, but perhaps, you know, even you said you didn't know all the details of her life. Perhaps since the whole book is really in many ways looking at her biographically, can you just kind of set us up with a kind of brief background of who she was and how she was generally remembered?
Yes, she was born in 1915 in Baltimore to a single mom, very, very difficult childhood, was singing in speakeasies and brothels in Baltimore by the time she was 12, came to New York shortly after that and made a name for herself in Harlem. By the time she was 20, or not even 20, she was recording with Benny Goodman, with later on with Lester Young. She was someone who was recognized by her most renowned jazz contemporaries as a genius from a very, very early age. Count Basie, whom she toured with when she was barely 20, 22, said that on the tours, the other members of the band would listen to her records after they had finished playing, just to learn from her, which was unheard of because most of the singers who accompanied the big bands in the 30s and 40s were considered almost an add-on. They were not the reason people came out to see the band, and they were considered window dressing in a sense. But she was very much a musician, considered very much a musician. She sang in a way that is so influential that I think when we hear her, when people hear her for the first time, she doesn't sound like someone who was singing from 60 or 70 years ago. She sounds like someone who is singing very much today. You know, my kids think that this stuff is, you know, not that old. It's mom's music, so it's pretty old, but it's not as old as they think it is, because it sounds to them like anything they might hear when they, you know, when they walk into Starbucks and it's more, you know, jazz or grown-up music. So her way of shaping the notes, her way of famously lagging behind the beat, sort of singing to a different tempo than her accompanists, was something that she really introduced as a vocalist, and it transformed vocal jazz. I think it also transformed the way in which jazz is played by anyone. Her most famous song that I think most listeners will recognize is Strange Fruit, her song about lynching that she sang in 1938. God Bless the Child is also a song that many people are familiar with. That's a song that's been covered many times. Some Billie Holiday songs are songs that many, many other people have sung. She sang the American Songbook. She sang a lot of songs from Broadway and early Hollywood. So they're songs that we know from just sort of what American music sounds like to most of us, 20th century American music. Then there are songs that others cover. God Bless the Child has been sung by all kinds of people. But then Strange Fruit is, I think, hers alone in that if you're going to sing Strange Fruit, you are really taking on an enormous project of being true to her voice, to her vision, and to what she wanted that, I think, that song to do for listeners. So she recorded throughout her short life. She began recording in 1933 when she was only 18. She died in 1959, and she was recording right up until the very end. I think even if your listeners don't imagine that they have heard Billie Holiday, as soon as they hear a Billie Holiday song, they will recognize her voice. Her voice is very distinctive and inimitable, even though people have for 70 years tried to imitate her phrasing and her way of shading the words that she sings.
Now, in the first chapter, you really get at what this kind of series is all about by exploring many of the tensions between the a myth of American greatness and the Black experience in America. What are some of the important social, musical, religious currents of the mid-20th century that we need to think about when we're thinking about Billie Holiday?
Well, I think, you know, one of the it's useful to think about how Black music reaches audiences, Black and white. What are the ways in which the musical tradition that Billie Holiday was brought into and with whose practitioner she was always compared, even though she has a little bit of a different trajectory from the more familiar ones that we associate with Black music, mid-20th century Black music. It's interesting for me to think about how that music reached audiences. So, of course, in the 19th century, we have Black music or music that is associated with the experience of enslaved African Americans on plantations. That music is made very light, made funny, and delivered as minstrelsy by usually white performers who made a national musical repertoire out of songs that were sung in the guise or the persona of Black slaves on a plantation. So that's partly how what we think of as Black music gets mediated broadcast to large audiences. Minstrel troupes would go from town to town and play a repertoire that then would become known to people all over the places where these troops toured. In the 20s, record companies who wanted to make a profit without paying their artists huge amounts of money found that signing Black blues singers was incredibly profitable because these records sold in very large quantities. There was a concerted effort to introduce Black music to Black audiences to sell Black records in dollar stores the itineraries of traveling salesmen to sell records to go along with tent shows where many Black performers made their names, drew audiences. And Black performers, unlike white performers who at that time were often still imitating Black performers, people like Al Jolson were singing in blackface and making huge amounts of money, but the Black performers themselves were sometimes paid $5, $10 a side. Billie Holiday, when she cut her first records, was paid $7.50 per song, no royalties. So Black voices get on record in a number of different ways that together tell a very interesting story about the way in which Black music comes to be America's music. It's interesting that by the late 30s, producers like John Hammond, the white, wealthy impresario who delivered so much Black music to white audiences in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, made a stage show at Carnegie Hall, which in his view would recreate the history of Black music from spirituals to swing, as he named the concert. So he was already looking at Black music as having a very particular kind of history that he could deliver to white audiences, largely white audiences, in the form of a kind of living diorama, a living genealogy of Black musical sound. And by that time, by the late 30s, the wealthy white producers who were still in a position of determining which Black singers got a hearing, which Black musical forms were supported, they were making the case that what the music that America itself was listening to, was gravitating toward, had its beginnings in a Black vernacular culture. So Billie Holiday comes into this tradition, of course, a large part of the Black musical tradition that is being broadcast in the 30s, being mediated and still being very lived in very powerful ways, is the Black church tradition, which produces what became what we became aware of as gospel, but which also launched many of the great blues singers in the 20s and 30s. Billie Holiday didn't come out of what we think of as a Black church tradition, an Afro-Protestant tradition, because she was raised in a city that was sort of on the cusp of the South and the North. She did not attend, as far as we know, an Afro-Protestant church. Her musical training in church was in the Gregorian chants of the Catholic Mass, which, as a Catholic schoolgirl, both at a what was known as a school for colored girls, a school for Black, a Catholic school for colored girls, as it was called, that she attended in Baltimore, and then a reform school, the House of the Good Shepherd for colored girls, where she was sent at age 10. She sang every morning at 6 a.m. A Catholic Mass with the chants that went along with that. So her training was very different from the training of many of the singers that we think of as her contemporaries, Bessie Smith or Mahalia Jackson, who have those big church voices. Billie Holiday never had that kind of voice. But she certainly knew that that was the musical conversation that she would find herself in. She knew how to frame a response to that tradition. God Bless the Child, she called a swing spiritual. This was her way of sort of entering into that conversation between spirituals and swing. So I'm very interested in the way in which Black artists navigated situations that were very difficult, very aversive, very much stacked against their having a lot of autonomy, they're having a lot of wherewithal in decisions about how they sounded, whom they sang for, who recorded them, and nevertheless created what we think of as American music.
Now, you move on to Holiday's 1956 autobiography, Lady Sings the Blues, and you place this within many of the realities of her social upbringing. And you read this in interesting ways in terms of the influences around how we might understand this. So how would you say we can read her autobiography alongside both kind of popular or more literary influences? And what role does her Catholic formation play in shaping her life? You discuss this in this chapter a lot.
Yes, well, her co-writer, or her ghostwriter, as many people assume, on that book was a guy named William Dufty. And he was a very interesting figure. He was a prolific writer. He wrote for a lot of, he wrote for the New York Post when it was a pretty respectable paper. He also wrote for a lot of sort of underworld magazines. He wrote confessional kinds of narratives. He ghost wrote a number of other books that were sometimes very pop in their subject matter, sometimes themselves a little bit tawdry. He wrote a confessional narrative with a priest who described the underside of what it meant to be a priest in America in the 30s and 40s. So he was a good writer, but he had a real sense for a story and what would make a story sell. And he liked being a little bit edgy. And he was very drawn to Billie Holiday because of his politics, but also because of her story. He thought that he could, with her, tell a very compelling story. And he himself was a lapsed Catholic. He had been married to a friend of Billie Holiday's and later to Gloria Swanson, the Hollywood star with whom he wrote a book about diet, of all things. But his son told me that he was very openly gay and eventually found a partner with whom he lived out the rest of his life. But so his relationship to Catholicism was always about the closet and about the way in which Catholicism provides certain structures, certain narratives for navigating a life that is lived a little bit on the down low. So he approached Billie Holiday about when they began working together on Lady Sings the Blues. And he said, tell me when you started lying in the confessional. He knew she was Catholic, and he joked that they saw eye to eye because they were both Irish Catholics. She apparently had some Irish in her, but that was not the tradition she was raised in. But he thought that they could understand each other on that level. She said, you know, no one has ever asked me that. I've been questioned by all kinds of feds. I've been, I've been cross-examined in court. No one has ever asked me when I started lying in the confessional. So it was a very interesting way to initiate their collaboration. And of course, in Christian tradition, this is the way a lot of spiritual biographies get written, between a confessor and a saint or a figure in relation to that confessor. So he brought out from Billie Holiday, and he also used a number of other sources that were available, other interviews that she had done. But he was able to elicit from her a kind of, I think of it as a kind of spiritual biography, a narrative of her struggles, of the very perilous situations that she had come out of. It didn't have a happy ending, because just as the book was going to press, she was arrested again for possession of heroin. He wanted the book to have to appeal to audiences who were looking for something that was a little bit gritty, a little bit edgy, which was Billie Holiday's reputation at that point. But I think that he and she too also were rooting this story through the structures of the narratives of the Catholic saints to which she was exposed in the House of the Good Shepherd, and which he also knew as a kid who had come through Catholic schools. They both were drilled in the Baltimore Catechism, so there are parts of the biography that seem, or the autobiography that seem, almost answers to questions about what kinds of sins would you need to confess? How would you make a full reckoning of your history, your behaviors? And I think in that sense, it was a collaborative spiritual biography that he helped Billie Holiday to write.
Yeah, it's interesting the way you frame it through that kind of Catholic lens. I think it's successful in pulling out a lot of kind of details that we might not think about, or other people might not think about. In the next chapter, you look at kind of the intersection of jazz and film in many ways, both films that exist and films that were imagined, as a lens to understand some of the religious confluences of musicians' worlds that they existed in. So can you tell us kind of how the story played out in the life of Holiday, and what it can tell us about the kind of spiritual migrations that informed her musical production?
Yes, the chapter of that title is The Story of Jazz, and that was the title for a film that Orson Welles planned to make in the early 40s. He had met Billie Holiday. He was quite enamored of her. It's likely that they were having an affair when she left New York and went to Hollywood to sing in a club that she had been singing in New York at a club called Cafe Society. And a Los Angeles producer wanted a West Coast Cafe Society, so she went out there to sing and met Orson Welles. Orson Welles was also a great jazz fan, and he wanted to make a film about Louis Armstrong. And he was using Louis Armstrong's biography, and he wanted Billie Holiday to play Bessie Smith in that film. And Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong recorded songs that Billie Holiday would have heard for the first time when she was a kid in Baltimore singing in brothels. She talks about playing their records on the Victrola in the brothels when she had a moment to herself. So this would have been a very, very exciting project. What happened, though, is that Orson Welles was, Pearl Harbor happened, and Orson Welles, like many other creative producers, filmmakers, was dispatched to various parts of the world to engage in a project of cultural diplomacy that would try to strengthen hemispheric alliances. So Welles and Walt Disney and a number of other artists were sent to Brazil. And Walt Disney makes some cartoons from this period. Orson Welles became very interested in Brazilian music and samba music. The story of Louis Armstrong that he was going to make was set in New Orleans. And what he hoped to do was to, in a revised version of this film that he had begun to imagine with Billie Holiday, he was hoping to do something that would compare jazz and Mardi Gras with samba music and carnival in Brazil. The film was never made. Billie Holiday did some war work and got into some trouble during the 1940s. The Orson Welles version of this film was abandoned, but in 1947, a group of principals came together and made a movie called New Orleans. And they took some of what Welles had abandoned for his script for The Story of Jazz, which was the film that he wanted to make. In the movie New Orleans, Louis Armstrong plays Louis Armstrong. Billie Holiday was tapped to play, not Billie Holiday. She was rather put in the role of a singing maid. There are other jazz musicians in the film who play themselves. The premise of New Orleans, which had also been the premise of Welles' abandoned movie, was to, in a sense, it was an early version of what some of the people listening to this might know as the Ken Burns series on jazz, you know, that starts in New Orleans and then shows jazz moving into the broader world. The film that Welles wanted to make starts in New Orleans and follows Armstrong as he moves to Chicago and then to New York. And the film New Orleans, the 1947 movie where Billie Holiday plays the maid, follows that same trajectory. Follows jazz in the person of Armstrong from New Orleans up the Mississippi River to Chicago and then into the broader world. So the film that was made and the film that Welles wanted to make but didn't both track the story of jazz in a sense to the story of the Great Migration, the story of Black Southerners coming north and shaping musical forms, cultural forms, along the way, such that what we think of as urban music by the 30s or 40s is very much an African American production. The religious angle there, I think, is very muted. Neither Welles nor the producer of the 1947 New Orleans movie talks very much about New Orleans as a Catholic city or the ways in which blues, which primarily comes out of Afro-Protestant traditions, mixes with jazz to become something that that sounds very recognizable to us by the 30s and 40s. But if I were, if I had a hand in making either of those films, that's something that I would have wanted to bring forward.
Another kind of interesting angle that you take here is through the kind of Jewishness of the American songbook. And you look at many of the relationships between the blackness of jazz music, but also the Jewishness of it. How do religious narratives figure in jazz music? What were some of the connections between black and Jewish musical productions? And then where does this kind of fit into Holiday's life?
That, you know, that was such a fascinating story for me to delve into. And I try to tell the story of this Black Jewish collaboration that is jazz through first the figure of Armstrong, who on his deathbed not quite on his deathbed, he lived a little bit longer, but in about 1970, he was really ailing and he had been traveling for decades, really, but the last decade since suffering a heart attack 10 years earlier, still continuing to travel and to play as a jazz ambassador, someone who traveled all over the world, to voice a kind of freedom, a kind of energy that the U.S. State Department wanted him to represent, so that Americans would have a particular image in the world that Armstrong could be the face of and the voice of. So he had been doing a great deal of cultural work, a great deal of work for the American government as a musician, and his lungs were pretty much destroyed by this time. And so he was in a hospital bed in Beth Israel Hospital in New York, and he starts writing his story, which he had done before. He had given us several versions of an autobiography, but this story, he sets in New Orleans. He calls it the story of Louis Armstrong and the Jewish family in New Orleans. And he centers the story almost entirely on a family named the Karnofskys, a large family, many, many children, who lived in the neighborhood where he came up in New Orleans, a very, very poor neighborhood. Armstrong was the son of a man who wasn't necessarily around too much, a woman who needed to work as a prostitute to feed her children. He was raised by grandmothers when his mother was not around, but he also worked as a laborer himself from the age of five, bringing in a paycheck. And he worked for this Karnofsky family, this Jewish family. And because Armstrong didn't have adults in his own family around as much as anyone might have liked to see, he was really taken in by the Karnofsky family. And he says in this narrative that they appreciated his singing. They taught him to sing. They gave him his first cornet. He changes a lot of the details that we know from his other autobiographies, which set his formation in a very different frame that emphasized other parts of his life. But in this version, he's talking about this Jewish family who took him in, who gave him his first horn, who appreciated his singing, who encouraged him to be someone, to be a musical performer. And he talks about the Irving Berlin song, Russian Lullaby. In this short narrative that he writes, he copies out the words to Russian Lullaby four or five times. And the Irving Berlin song, Russian Lullaby, had not even been published then in the time that Armstrong is setting his reminiscences, but it's what it anchors all of his memories here. And what's so fascinating to me about that document is that it seems to be an attempt to articulate this love affair, this nurturing relationship between Armstrong as a performer and all of the Jewish mentors, producers, songwriters who put him to business, who put him in business, who brought him out of New Orleans and helped him to become Louis Armstrong. Of course, he provided the presence, the genius, the talent that was Louis Armstrong, but his manager for many years, Joe Glazer, he loved, even though we know Joe Glazer was not a particularly savory figure, certainly not helpful to Billie Holiday. He sang the American Songbook, so he sang the songs, the lyrics of many Jewish composers and lyricists. And this relationship is one that we often think of as quite fraught, the relationship between Jews and African Americans in American history. But in Armstrong's narrative, he really portrays it as a love affair and as a family story, that the family that he grew up in, the family that made him who he was a Jewish family. So Billie Holiday herself, of course, like any great singer in the 30s and 40s, who was able to record and sing the music of composers then who sort of ran the song business, sang mostly Jewish songs. These were songs that were written by Irving Berlin, by the Gershwins, by Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart, Dorothy Fields. All of the great songs that we associate with Billie Holiday, the vast majority were written by Jewish songwriters. And the story of Jewish songwriting is its own fascinating story. But one of the things that I find very, very poignant about Holiday's relationship in particular with the Jewish songwriting tradition is in the way that she understood, I think, her most famous Jewish song, Strange Fruit, in a way that was a little bit different from the way that the Jewish composer of that song, Abel Meeropol, understood it. If you think about the way in which the Gershwins, for example, created the repertoire for many, many Black artists in Porgy and Bess or in Showboat, also a book that was written, a songbook that was written by Jewish composers. Much of the songs that Black performers like Paul Robeson were able to sing and were able to make their names, to achieve fame and renown by singing, were by Jewish composers. And for many of the Black performers who sang in this tradition, there didn't seem to be anything untoward about singing the songs of white Jewish lyricists and composers. When Showboat was revived late in the 20th century, there was consternation among some African-American performers and audiences that what the Black performers on stage were singing was a very unflattering version of Black history that had been written for them by Jews. There's actually some very uncomfortable back and forth about this in the 90s and the early 2000s. Billie Holiday didn't ever weigh in on whether singing Gershwin or singing Irving Berlin was in any way compromising for her. But the song around which some of these uncomfortable energies came to cluster is Strange Fruit. And that was written for her, or it was written by a Jewish composer whose name was Abel Meeropol. He wrote under the name of Lewis Allen. And he was a Jewish high school teacher, labor organizer, a social justice warrior, someone might call him today. Very, very sincere, very powerful in his politics, very committed to using his artistry in order to advance his commitment to equality among the all races, equality among all religions. And he wrote Strange Fruit, the song about lynching, because this was before the Holocaust, but he, as a Jew, understood and in his writings really conveyed a strong sense, a strong awareness that as a Jew, the story of lynching was his own story. He wrote a poem that he planted in lots of different things that he wrote that went, I am a Jew, how may I tell? The Negro lynched reminds me well, I am a Jew. So his story about lynching, it's a very specific scene that he paints. It's the scene of Southern lynching. The lynched body is an African-American body. But in Meeropol's telling, the story was more universal. In Billie Holiday's rendering of that song, the story of lynching is something that for her is still very, very present, very, very real. For Meeropol, it was something that we were leaving behind. It was something that we were marching away from. It was something that the commitment to social justice would lead us away from. It would be a part of the past that we could look back at and shudder, but it was something that we were not going to carry into the future. This was his progressive vision. For Holiday, the scene of lynching in Strange Fruit was very much a scene in the present. She believed that her own father had died for want of care in the South. He contracted pneumonia, and as she believed, could not have been treated in a hospital, a white hospital. And she said this was another pastoral scene of the gallant South. That this was another kind of lynching, and that these lynchings were happening all around us all the time. And so she sang Strange Fruit as something that was a witness to something that was very, very much happening in the present. Well, Meeropol and Holiday never resolved a conflict Meeropol brought up he objected to the way in which the scene of that song's composition was reported, rendered in Lady Sings the Blues. The paragraph in the book about Holiday coming into possession of this song suggested that she had had a hand in writing it. And Mirpal said, no, absolutely not. She did not write it. She had nothing to do with it. It was entirely my song. And his sons continued the effort to make it clear that Abel Mirpal himself had written Strange Fruit, words and music that Holiday, in their view, had nothing to do with it. And of course, if you listen to Strange Fruit, you know it's Billie Holiday's song, no matter who wrote it. But I think it had to do with the way in which the telling of the scene of lynching would go, and who got to tell that story, and what the story was about. Was it something that happened in the past that we could move on from, or was it something that was happening in the present? And so I wonder if, for Billie Holiday, this was maybe a way of thinking about her relationship to a songwriting tradition, largely Jewish, where she would get these songs, she would put her indelible stamp on them, she would make them her own. The relationship between her as the artist and the Jewish producers, songwriters, composers was perhaps never quite as smooth as it was for someone like Armstrong, who left us a record of feeling and wanting to make good on an enormous debt that he experienced in relation to Jewish songwriting and Jewish production.
Now, in the final chapter, you use elements from the Catholic tradition to help us understand what you call, I think, in the introduction, the mytho-poetic nature of Holiday's iconicity. So in what ways did Holiday understand herself, and how is she remembered and understood within the ideals of jazz music?
Well, I think in jazz music, she stands alone. I think she really was the first jazz singer who sang in the way that a great jazz instrumentalist would play. And I think she not only taught jazz singers to sing, but she taught many jazz instrumentalists to play. So her iconicity as a jazz singer, in the way of technique, in the way of achievement, I think she certainly stands alone, and we don't necessarily need to bring religion in to understand that. But then there's another part to her iconicity, which sees her as a tragic heroine, someone who is beautiful and damned, to use Scott Fitzgerald's term, someone who is very too beautiful for this world, who was too radiant, too talented, too beautiful to survive. That she was so enormously talented, so enormously gifted, the world had no way to appreciate her gift, and so they needed to make sure that she didn't live to enjoy it, or that she didn't live a life that was at all tolerable to her. So she very much has carries with her, bears the weight of this narrative of tragedy, of being doomed, of being too good for this world, too beautiful for this world. And many biographers and jazz fans, listeners, have said, wait a minute, you know, let's just get rid of that. That's a stock narrative. That's a hackneyed story that is demeaning to her. It's demeaning to women. It's demeaning to African-American performers. Let's just lay that aside, the story of Billie Holiday's The Tragic Heroine, and let's appreciate her genius, her music. I'm all for that. I think that is a very powerful position. But I also think that Billie Holiday herself was trained in habits of self-constitution that made it possible for her, made it somehow allowable for her, or inevitable to some degree, that she would herself imagine her life in these terms, that she would imagine herself in the mold of, or in the tradition of, many of the Catholic women saints to whom she had been exposed in the Catholic Reform School, who themselves lived lives of great pain, great penance, who lived very difficult lives, and in the very difficulty of those lives that they led, achieved a kind of beatific radiance. And the reason I say that is because in the Reform School particularly, Billie Holiday, along with other girls who entered into that environment, were asked to put their own names aside. Her name at that time was Eleonora Fagan, or Guff. It later became when her mother married a man named Guff. But she put the name Eleonora aside and took a new name, a saint's name, Madge or Magdalene in one instance, and Teresa in another. She actually had two stints at the House of the Good Shepherd, and would have been encouraged, as all of the girls were, to model herself, her choices, her behaviors in the mold or the framework of this particular saint. And the saints to which these girls were exposed were the ones who had stories like theirs, or stories like the lives that these girls were encouraged to craft for themselves. That I was in a position of great peril. I was without support, without friends. I got into trouble with drugs, with men, with liquor, with the law, with various snares and temptations. And yet, having fallen very, very low, very far, I was able to reconstruct my life along the path of penitence or penance. I was able to become a one of these women in the Catholic tradition who, through penance, was able to reconstruct a life that would be favored by God. And of course, we know that many of the stories in this tradition are ones that are very damaging to women, that suggest lives that are very, very constrained, that imagine spiritual success as a function of suffering, how much suffering one is able to bear or sustain. And yet these were the stories that Billie Holiday was given. And I think when she tells her own story, it's very much a story of pain and peril and prejudice, many, many unfair kinds of situations, many difficult kinds of situations accruing to her, her persona as someone who was very much at the mercy of a difficult world. And yet from that pain, from that, from all of those very difficult circumstances, she was able to craft something that was shining and transcendent and radiant. And I think very much that was her sense of herself. It was a story that she was willing to tell about herself, that she knew how to tell about herself. So it shouldn't surprise us that that is the story that many people have retained of Billie Holiday, that she was damaged, that she was abused, that she was treated unfairly, that she lived with a great deal of pain and suffering. And yet from that place of pain and suffering, she was able to create something astoundingly beautiful.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's been a real pleasure hearing you talk about it as well, I must say. Before I let you go, though, can you tell us some of the things you're working on now?
You know, Christian, ever since the November 2016 election, I have really had a hard time writing anything that didn't attempt to come to terms somehow with our present moment. So my writing has gotten a lot more political, even though I, you know, I've taught religion and politics for a long time. I'm having to recreate that course from scratch, because I don't know that anything I was able to put forward before 2016 could have predicted the world we're in now. So